back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively through the bye week, and my back is back, and all the cancellations and postponements of October, we are putting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour together, sponsored by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. We'll be playing on Thursday at Silver Spring Mining Company in Perry Hall. Lots of guests. Rob Santoni is going to join us from Wise Markets. Gary Risling, former Skipjack, will be there, as well as Councilman David Marks. Then on Friday, we're in Fells Point. We're going to be down at the Chop Tank at the Atlas Group. Ron Furman, my musician buddy, Eddie Lauer, is going to be dropping by with his guitar. Merritt Dworkin is going to be joining us. Lots of friends. Ron Furman talking some old rock and roll as well. But it is Vikings week around here. My wife's favorite memory of going to the game in the snowstorm 8 years ago. I don't think it'll be snowing this week, but I watched Kirk Cousins play, and I certainly watched the Ravens get annihilated by the Bengals 2 weeks ago, and then watched the Bengals lose to the Jets. It's a wild, wacky National Football League schedule, and we're into the second half. I'm going to Minnesota right now. Pat Borzi writes about sports and things and life, and actually, this is kind of a cool thing because he's a New Yorker who lives in Minnesota. I got a lot of Minnesota folks that I'm bringing on this week. Pat, you're always a great willing foil and guest anytime the Twins are we don't get together with the Vikings very often. How are things in the Twin City? It's good to have you on, man.
Thanks, Nestor. Glad to be here. No, you will not be getting snow this weekend. And in fact, it's actually quite nice here. It's in the for the first week in November. It's in the 40s, and no, it's not a snowflake in sync.
We've had one snow game here in the history of the franchise. So, when I was a kid, you know, Colts, I would see pictures of old games. My dad's and then in the 70s, I went to a couple of snow games. I was at a snow game against the Patriots in the 70s. So, I had attended such events, right? And I'd gone to Pittsburgh for some snow games. But you don't get as many. Global warming's involved. You folks that play, you know, in these crazy places where it's 5 degrees all winter, build domes anyway. So, we actually had this snow globe game here 8 years ago that I don't know that it'll ever be replicated. You know, I mean, it's a confluence. Well, now they were playing football into January. We've added weeks into the season, maybe, but it was kind of fun. And we don't know much about the Vikings. I mean, every 4 years we get together, but watching them play this week on Sunday night against the Cowboys, it looks like a diminished version, specifically defensively, when you can't defend yourself against a guy who's never played in the league. Unzimmer-like, I would say, for the Vikings, right?
Yeah. They've been doing some things that you kind of scratch your head and go, this is a guy who's been a head coach here for 8 years. And he's doing things like calling timeouts he doesn't have. He's not calling a timeout at the end of the first half when they're trying to scramble and get a playoff. I mean, they got booed off the field Sunday night because of how they mismanaged the time at the end of the first half. There's a lot of conversation here about what's wrong and why they're only 3-4 when they've been in every game, and pretty much every game that they have has been a one score game. And you know, there were a lot of people that wanted the coach fired Monday morning and are probably very surprised that he still has a job.
By the way, my lasting image of Minnesota, and I've been there many times, and I love your place, and you obviously loved it. You moved there, and I want to hear that story. But I'll never ever forget the night I met Brian Billick. Literally, the night I met Brian Billick was the night that the Dirty Bird happened, and they lost the championship game. It was the last game he was there, and I covered that game. I actually had tickets in the upper deck. There were Art Modell seats, and I had a press box seat, and I was down in the locker room when all hell broke loose and the 15-1 season went away and like all that. And I'll never forget getting in the car and listening to sports radio in Minnesota, and everybody wanted Denny Green fired. Yeah. And I'm thinking, you're 15-1. You just lost by and that was a decision that with the sit on the ball, all that stuff, right?
What was going on
in the aftermath of that. But I'm thinking, you know, when you don't win Super Bowls, we don't have a lot of fire John Harbaugh around here. You know, we didn't have a whole lot of fire Brian Billick. I mean, the owner was one of the few people that really wanted him fired. I would think when there's disappointment, you know what I mean? We've had a couple of parades here, hopefully have more, Lamar, all that. But I think there's a different thing in places where, you know, Fran Tarkington is the, you know, and the team's always good. The Vikings are always good.
That's right. Here's what you got to understand about the way Vikings fans are here. And I used to work in Boston, too, before the Red Sox started winning World Championships after that long, 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 long drought. There's the exact same mindset here. It's been the Vikings, as you know, have never won a Super Bowl. They've won four times, lost all four times. There's a sense of, I don't want to say entitlement because that's the wrong word, but there's so much of the, these guys are going to blow it again. And folks just are just so frustrated. They just, and every year they start with the, this is going to be the year. This is going to be the year. And then stuff happens and folks just go crazy. It's exactly like Red Sox fans were for all those years when they couldn't beat the Yankees, when they couldn't get to the World Series.
Or the Cubs or the Royals.
It's actually worse.
Or the Eagles.
Well, I'll tell you what.
The Chiefs, you know.
Listen to me, Lester. It's actually worse than the Cubs. Because the Cub fans at least could say, well, you know, we're in a historic ballpark. You know, Chicago's a great city, you know. And it's, believe me, having spent enough time in Chicago, have spending 8 years in Boston, and then spend, what is it, oh, like 18 years here, and growing up in New York.
Well, the hardest part, I can tell you, Packers have won, right? The Packers have had, their rival has won a lot.
And that's interesting, too, because the Packers consider the Bears their big rival.
No doubt about it.
But the Vikings fans, you know, every time that Aaron Rodgers has a great game, every time the Packers pull a game out, Vikings fans are just ripping their hair out because they're like, why can't we get a quarterback like this? Well, which is a great question. And just as, you know, why can't we win a Super Bowl? Why can't we get back to a Super Bowl? You know, the Packers have this tradition, and, you know, for 20-something years, I mean, the Packers have had two great quarterbacks in the last 25 years. The Vikings have had two quarterbacks in the last 2 years, kind of.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not in the last 2 years, but if you go back and you look at all the different guys that they've cycled through, you know, going all the way back to, you know, Dante Culpepper, and now it's Cousins, and then all the guys in between.
I remember losing a game in Minnesota. The last time I saw a game at the Metrodome was it was Brett Favre, on the Vikings side. That was 12 years ago, I guess, because everything happens in four-year increments, right?
Right, yeah. And folks here, I mean, that was supposed to be the time. You know, they had a great team on both sides of the ball. All he needed was a quarterback. And the first year Favre was here, he was phenomenal. And then, you know, they go down to New Orleans, and you know what happened there. And then the next year, he came back. He wasn't as good. He was old. He was beaten up. And then, you know, they've been trying to get back to that level ever since. And, you know, a couple of years ago where they had that miracle play that gets them through the first round of the playoffs, and then they meet Philly, and they just get steamrolled. And then folks are still reeling from that. You know, there's this –
well,
when
that would have been a home
be
Super
our
Bowl.
Year,
yeah, I was there that week after they lost that game. That was such a hangover. And then the Eagles fans came in and they had a good time. It was a good game. I mean, Philly special, all that. It was very memorable Super Bowl. I mean, for me, I wound up at the Eagles victory party. So like, hey, that was a wild, crazy 5-degree week in Minnesota. Yeah. But for the fans there, for the lead up, you know, when I'm sitting on. Going to live there for a week and broadcast there for a week. I'm like, oh my God, this would be glorious. Cause my first Super Bowl was the Minnesota Super Bowl in 92 back in the day that I went to. So like, I there's a part of me that wants the Vikings to win. I have a soft spot for the Vikings, you know? And I guess that's why I ask, because Vikings fans are pissed off. There's a lot of angst for being such nice people, Minnesota nice, right?
Yeah. This is, they reserve all the anger for this team. And, you know, now, and of course, you probably heard the news yesterday that Daniel Hunter, their best pass rusher, is going to be out for the year with the torn pectoral muscle. So now they've got even more problems. It's going to be interesting to see how they deal with that. I mean, their defense has been, you know, they get a pretty good pass rush, but their defense has kind of been up and down. They've given up a lot of points, but they've also made a lot of plays. And, you know, their offense, they're kind of struggling. Clint Kubiak, who's Gary Kubiak's kid, who's the offensive coordinator, first-year play caller. He's been getting a lot of heat because it seems like the beginning of the games, when they start with the scripted plays, they score. And then until the very end of the half or the very end of the game, you know, they can move the ball, but then in between they struggle. I mean, they have a terrific running back in Cook. They've got a couple of great receivers. They should be able to move the ball better than they do. You know, Cousins, for, you know, all the criticism that he gets, has actually had a decent year. Exactly what the problem is really hard to figure out, but the thinking here is that they should be better than they are.
Well, certainly what we saw with the Cowboys beating them with a quarterback that's never been on the field and said that he felt like he belonged. And I thought, Vikings defense made you feel like you belong. I hope they make Lamar feel like they belong. Pat Borsey's here. He covers all things sports. Give everybody your journey, because you've been a guest on the show over the last decade on radio. It's the first time in the video era I've had you on. But, you know, all across the country, there are displaced humans like you that would have been me, moving around the world, writing about sports, covering sports. There's a huge fraternity of us, some getting squeezed out on the other side or going to .coms or going to teams and doing different things. You are a sports writer to some degree. Yeah,
I guess. Yeah. If that's how you want to put it. You know, the journey is, you know, I almost don't want to call it a journey. It's just kind of a job description. You know, I grew up in New York. I wanted to be a sports writer from when I was a kid.
And I have that in common. I wanted to be Oscar Madison or John Stedman.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. John Stedman was a terrific writer for many, many years in that town. And that's a wonderful person to emulate.
He was my mentor, you know. So,
well, there you go. And an excellent choice. Well done.
That's why I'm still here. I was taught well.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. You know, I was, a clerk at Newsday on Long Island, you know, my hometown paper, when I was in college at Fordham University in New York. And Fordham's produced a lot of really good journalism people. And
Joe Favorito. You know Joe? You ever
know
Joe?
Joe? Yeah. Sure. Joe, I haven't seen Joe in a long time. I hope he's doing well.
No, Joe's doing great, man. I ran into him randomly in Jersey City in the train station, literally randomly in life. But I see him at the Super Bowl and whatnot. But, yeah, Fordham's got a huge movement in sports in general. A lot of sports people went to Fordham.
We have a lot of guys that are in broadcasting. We have a lot of guys who are in print. In fact, our most famous guy, our most famous broadcaster is, of course, Vin Scully. And on the print side, my college classmate, who's not a sports writer, but very well accomplished, the late Jim Dwyer, a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, columnist for the New York Times. And for how I got here, pretty easy. I moved around a bit. You know, I worked 8 years at the Miami Herald. Then I went to Boston, where I was the Boston correspondent for the Portland Press Herald up in Maine. And that's where I got my first taste of all four of the major men's pro sports. So I was covering the Patriots, the Red Sox, the Celtics, and the Bruins. So I covered the last few years that Bird, McHale, and Parrish were together. I covered the Patriots in their decline and then in their rise when Parcells took over as head coach before Belichick got there. So I was kind of among the many people that were chronicling their rise to prominence under Bill Parcells.
And the Red Sox meant everything and could do nothing. Literally.
And you know, here's the thing. It's really funny. If you want to talk about my career trajectory, and I ended up, you know, I worked for the Newark Star Ledger. I covered the Yankees and the Mets and did the Olympics did a bunch of different things for them over 6 years. And then I met this wonderful woman who writes for the Minneapolis Star Tribune named Rachel Blount. And we decided we wanted to spend the rest of our lives together. And so I quit my job and I moved here. And I've been freelancing ever since. And Rach is about to cover her 13th Olympics, which would be one more than Bob Costas, something I'm very, very proud to say. She'll never tell you that, but I will. And
well, I got to have her on to talk Olympics then one time. So for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. I might be able to negotiate that one for you.
The Olympics are an amazingly elusive thing for me, because in all my life, it's the one thing I've never done. I mean, I've not covered, but I've been to World Cups. I've been to bullfights in Madrid. I'm that guy. I've never been to a rugby match or like Aussie football, but I've been all over the world doing stuff. I always wanted to go to Wimbledon, never made it, but I went to the French and I've been to the US. So I've, I don't really have a my bucket list. There's one thing left on my bucket list is to see the Northern Lights at some point. But other than that, like the sports things I haven't seen. But the Olympics is one of those things that's so filthy to me and sort of politically dirty. Even the World Cup. We're trying to get World Cup games here in 26, right?
Yeah.
Just how the political side of what happens in Athens, in Rio, in the aftermath of all of this. And I've been to a lot of places. I was in Beijing before the Olympics with Ripken doing like a whole media thing with the government, mm-hmm. all of that. But I've never actually walked into an Olympic event, and I'm a Lake Placid and a Nadia Comaneci 70s. And certainly, right. I would tell anybody I've interviewed, this is my 30th anniversary next month. Mary Lou Retton might have been the favorite thing I've ever done, ever, ever, ever in radio. She sat for 12 minutes and had ice cream with me at the Super Bowl in Houston a few years ago. So I love the Olympics in that way, but it's one of those things that I had a chance to go to Atlanta in 96. My buddy called me at the end. There were always rooms available. And this is one, he's like, hey, I'm flying down. It's $59. You want to go? This is 1996. And yeah. The bomb went off the weekend. I would have been sort of there doing something or whatever. And I didn't have a whole lot of money. It was one of those, nah. And then since then, I've never even considered it. So people that have covered the Olympics, it's almost like talking to astronauts to me for a little, you know, to some degree, you know?
Yeah, well, I've covered two myself. I've covered the Nagano Winter Olympics in 98, where I met my wife, and the Sydney Olympics in 2000. And I can tell you that, I mean, you're right about everything that's going on with the International Olympic Committee and the back and forth and the stuff that you really go, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff around the politics of the Olympics that are just really not good. But when you're standing in a Sydney Olympic stadium and Kathy Freeman is coming around the final turn in the 800 meters and the entire stadium is standing and cheering for one of your countrymen who's about to do something incredible, there's a rush that comes over you that, you know, I've covered 9 World Series and 3 Super Bowls and a bunch of other really cool things. And there's a rush that comes over you at that moment that I've never experienced in any other sporting event that I've been to.
I missed, you know what, he went to Atlanta. He went to the Michael Johnson. Does that sound right? Is it the gold shoes? Wasn't that Atlanta 96?
My
buddy went to that event and said, and my buddy is like an accomplished human. He's been all over the world, Springsteen, concerts, yeah, things. He would still tell you it was a top fiver. So he always says to me, you should have done that. And I'm like, I was at the Leyritz home run as an example. I think I covered 90 World Series games in my life. Yeah. I've been to 90 games. I was trying to do the math the other day on, even in 1979 with my dad and 83 when I was a kid, I went to the 86 World Series, the Shea, the Red Sox. So I've been to some games, but I when I think about the Olympics and thinking about watching Usain Bolt sprint or seeing Ali light the torch, you know, different things like that. Sydney is fascinating because I saw Springsteen in that area where they built all of the stadia and staging events.
In the Olympic Park, yeah.
And they take the subway 45 minutes out, you know, of downtown Sydney, and there's just this place where they built something that 21 years later, they're still using, right? And then I saw what they were doing in Brazil, building stadiums in the middle of the rainforest, and what they're doing in Dubai, and it's just gotten off the rails, Pat, right? I mean, it really has, from what was always political from 1968 and Munich and even back into the 40s and 50s with Hitler, right? But where this has gone with kings and sultans and money and displacing people and people dying, building these things, that's the dirty part of it that it has to be talked about in addition to Usain Bolt, Michael Johnson, to Kathy Freeman, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're about to hold the Winter Olympics in Beijing, in a country that has as horrible a human rights reputation as any country that's ever been around. They're picking sites. I've always been among the people, and there are more and more of us that simply just pick 4 sites and just rotate them among these 4 sites, you know, in perpetuity, because it costs so much money to build these facilities. And in a lot of countries, like you mentioned in Brazil, they don't get used, you know, once the Olympics are over. You know, you can, you know, and we can debate.
Well, I saw the Athens stuff where they built a baseball stadium that had like dog weed growing through it, right? Years later, because what do they need it for?
Right, because I mean they play a little baseball over there, but it's not like here. You spend a lot of money on facilities that don't get used, and why should every city that wants to build an Olympics put themselves in hock just to build a bunch of facilities you're going to use for 3 weeks? It just doesn't make any sense. And you got some great cities that already have terrific facilities, and we could sit here and debate which four cities you should do it in. But the fact is, there are so few cities now that want to host an Olympics that the International Olympic Committee is now awarding them to places that probably shouldn't get them. Norway pulled out of the bid for a Winter Olympics bid because of the requirements that the IOC has that every host country has to do during the Olympics, including every major IOC official has to be greeted at the airport by the highest head of state. And there are specific requirements that you have to have in place when this person lands. And including things like you have to have, they always have to be put up in a 5-star hotel and all this ridiculous stuff as if it was a reigning monarch that was coming and not the IOC president. It's this kind of stuff that is making countries go, we don't want any part of this. This is lunacy.
Well, it's a mafia. It's not a sporting event. It becomes that. Pat Borsi's our guest. We were talking all things Minnesota. Yeah, when we talk about stadia and places that do it right and do it wrong, and we brought Sydney into this, you're in the Twin Cities. That's a fascinating story there. I mean, every one of these municipalities, especially now that the owners got together last week and Stan Kroenke's rolled on the rest of the guys and St. Louis and L.A. and what's going to become of the Chargers and the Jaguars in the end, what cities in Europe they're going to play in, probably London and Frankfurt before it's all over with, because the league is so hungry for money. The Vikings and to some degree the birth of the Timberwolves and what became of the North Stars and now the Wild. Minnesota's had a very sort of slippery path with all of this since taking the Senators and, putting the Vikings, whether it was the Met Stadium that became a mall and then the Metrodome wasn't good enough and the Vikings were in peril and they wind up building two really good facilities in your Target Field. I've been to every stadium except the one in Atlanta because it's new, but I've been to all the rest of the baseball stadiums. I did a baseball tour in 15. I did 30 ballparks in 30 days. I love Target Field. I haven't been back. I was back in winter and there wasn't a game going on a couple of years ago during the World Series. Yeah. But I would tell anybody if they want to experience a baseball game, go in. And I think your football stadium of all of them, because the Stones were playing all these places. And I was just talking about a friend of mine's a Stones fan, said, what about this? What about that? I'm like, well, the Atlanta stadium's like all the other domes, but the Minnesota one's kind of cool and kind of different. And if you want a different vibe, go to the Twin Cities. And certainly bringing politics into this and what happened last year and George Floyd, and we've had Freddie Gray in our city. Minnesota took on a whole different light last year, but from a sports community, a rich heritage, you've moved there with your wife, which is a beautiful story, but you moved to a place where there's like sports matters. I mean, not just Big Ten and Minnesota and they have their own stadium and whatnot, but there's a very vibrant thing there because sports has been important the last 50 years there.
Right. Yeah. And let's not also presume that everybody here was waving the pom-poms to get all these stadiums built. The Twins took a long time to get the bill for Target Field passed through the legislature. And it only got passed because they finally figured out that
they were going to get contracted, right?
Well, that was the threat. There were a whole bunch of other threats. They were going to move to North Carolina, and it turns out that the guy that they were going to sell it to didn't have any money. And that really soured a lot of people here on helping the Twins. And what they were finally able to do with the Target Field bill in the state legislature is they figured out a way where the outstate counties, there's like nine metro, in the metro area, there's like a nine county area.
Like Hennepin, I know those names, right?
Yeah, Hennepin and Hennepin and Ramsey, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What they figured out in the bill is that as long as the outstate counties didn't have to pay for it, they'd vote for it. So one of the tax increments that was passed only affects the metropolitan areas. So if you live in Eveleth, Minnesota, if you live in Duluth, Minnesota, if you live in Moorhead, Minnesota, any place other than the greater Twin Cities area, you did not get any you didn't have to pay any tax money towards the stadium. And everybody was like, cool. And so they voted it in. The Viking Stadium was an even harder one to get through in a lot of ways, because there's a Minneapolis city charter. In the charter, it says that you can't build another stadium without a referendum in the city. And if they the legislation that they passed somehow circumvented that. If they had this had gone to a referendum, because people didn't want to vote for the stadium. If this had gone to a referendum, it would have been voted down, and the Vikings would still be playing in the Metrodome, or it might be playing in another city. There was a lot of back and forth of whether or not the threat to move was legitimate at the time. But as we've seen, you know, the LA area built a new stadium now for the for the Rams and the Chargers. So maybe there would have been something there. What's interesting now is that in Minneapolis, now that you have Mark Laurie and Alex Rodriguez, who bought the Timberwolves, and they're talking about a new facility, there is no appetite in Minneapolis for building a new facility. Now, in St. Paul, they built a stadium for the soccer team, Minnesota United.
And I'm seeing that happening everywhere. There's a little soccer stadium going up in St. Louis. I was in St. Louis seeing the Stones a couple weeks ago, and you know, seeing the aftermath of when you get your team taken away, right? Minnesota's had all the threats in the world, right? Other than the Lakers, right? But I mean, in modern days, they've gotten it done because it's been important there.
Yeah. They've managed to get it done. But like I'm saying, there's now a bit of stadium fatigue here. And it's going to be I'm very curious to see how Lori and A-Rod are going to get a new facility, because Target Center was where they played was just renovated. And it was a very expensive renovation, a multi-million dollar renovation. It's better than it was, but it's still not as state of the art as a lot of the newer facilities around the NBA. And you know how this works. As soon as Jerry Jones built his stadium down in Arlington, everybody wanted one of those. Every other NFL owner wanted one of those. As soon as you get a couple of newer facilities built in the NBA, everybody wants one of those. And it's the same in baseball. I mean, once Camden Yards got built, then everybody wanted their own Camden Yards, and that's how Target Field ended up happening. It's going to be really interesting to see whether or not they're going to get any public money to build a new basketball arena. And by the way, the hockey arena over in St. Paul that got built, it's only 20 years old, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's still one of the premier facilities in the NHL. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Timberwolves, I've said this for years, I wouldn't be surprised if the Timberwolves end up playing over there at some point, either temporarily or maybe permanently.
Pat Borzy is joining us from the Twin Cities. The Vikings are in town this week. The Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. We're going to be back out on the road this week. Silver Spring Mining on Thursday. Friday, we're at the Chop Tank in Fells Point. Then next week, Fadley's on Wednesday. Nick's Grandstand Grill in Timonium on Friday. And then on the 17th with our mayor, Brandon Scott, at Coco. So a lot of crab cakes coming in here. So from the Vikings' perspective and your football wisdom here, this Lamar Jackson thing, when I talk to people like you in places that only see us every 4 years and watch Lamar from afar in another conference or whatever, this is one of the more interesting experiments on the landscape of sport. And every time I watch baseball, I see the whole sport has moved and shifted and analytics and all of that. But running this offense for the Ravens, it's been a wild experiment, the revolution of John Harbaugh 4 years ago. And that, it's working. It's still, especially if you're the Vikings and you're Zimmer and you got to figure this defensive thing out where you're already having some problems chasing Lamar around, and it becomes a real challenge for teams that don't ever see this.
Yeah. I'm really curious to see how they're going to defend this guy. Because again, you know, to me, the best way to defend a guy like that is to just pressure him, you know? But now their best pass rusher is out for the year. Everson Griffin, who they brought back this year, has been playing more than they probably expected, because he's been playing really, really well. And you know, if you don't contain Jackson, you guys could put up, the Ravens could put up a lot of points in a hurry, and they're going to be big problems. And, you know, he's already, you know, Zimmer is already, I mean, Zimmer being a defensive guy is already in a tough spot here. And if anything less than a terrific performance, and he's going to really be in some trouble.
Still a baseball guy? I mean, you spent a lot of nights up lately with the Yankees, right?
Yeah. And in fact, I had Sunday off, so I was switching between the World Series game and the Vikings game as I was sitting here in the South Minneapolis bureau, as it were.
Have you enjoyed this? I mean, not even to who's going to win or because it doesn't matter to me. I mean, the Astros are cheaters and I hate cheaters, but I don't have a good cop, bad cop. I mean, my team loses 107 games every year and we're trying to keep the team out of Nashville. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like we
I
have
understand.
A whole different thing going on here with baseball.
I feel for you, man. That's a rich tradition that you guys had, and what's going on there now is not good.
It's an amazing thing watching Daniel Snyder and watching these owners not roll onto him and knowing what Angelos, what a piece of filth he's been for 30 years, and we've been subjected to it. No one in Major League Baseball, and the Nationals exist, and what's happened to my city, you know, my city of ruins downtown on summer nights with 3,800 people coming to baseball. It's insane, right? So, and I'm in the middle of all, and I'm the bad guy for like pointing a light on it right here. But no one cares anymore about baseball here. And the really weird part is, and I have Luke on all the time who covers it, still goes down there 60, 70 nights a year, sits in our press box seat, you know, the whole deal. And my last name's Aparicio. You know, the reason I exist and live and I'm here is because Louis brought my father over in 1964, and that's why I'm breathing, right? So baseball is a big part of my life. I did the tour in 15, and since then, I don't watch a lot of baseball. I'm not proud of that. I'm not bragging about it. No one else, no one I know watches a whole lot of baseball here. And then when I put it on, when I helicopter in October, and I've been on my ass, Pat. I hurt my back. You know, I like most of October, I've really been hurting and laying down. And now you have all these games on at 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock. The Dodgers and the Giants are on all night.
Yeah.
And I just – what's the old Barry Manilow song? I've looked up, down, trying to get that feeling again. And I watch these shifts, the players, starting pitchers leaving with two outs in the first inning. Like, it's just not recognizable to me. And
yeah.
I see Nasty Jack on talking about 91 and the Metrodome and Game 7. And I have all of our people on, you know, people that wrote books, you know, about those World Series and stuff. They're great friends of mine. And I love baseball and I like talking about baseball. But when it comes to you and me talking about Game 4 the other night and like sitting here like the way I did for the first 20 years of my career, it's just over in that way. And these shifts and 4.5-hour games, I can't stay awake for it. And it's not because I go to bed early. I don't find it compelling. I mean, I find it like a band that I used to like and I don't love the songs anymore. And it's just like, I don't need to listen to that anymore. I can listen to Zeppelin instead. I can watch football. I can read a book. I can do something else.
Here's, you're touching on something that I've been railing about for several years now. What baseball has allowed itself to do in little increments is it's allowed its game a lot of different things to filter in to become unwatchable to a lot of people, to guys like you and me who grew up with a certain kind of baseball. Now, I don't want to be this grouchy old man, get off my lawn, and everything was better when I was a kid.
And it would be okay if the kids were digging it. They're not. They think it sucks too.
Well, and because it's not interesting. You know, what makes an interesting baseball game? Stealing bases, a terrific defensive play, you know, a big rally. You know, two of the three things that really make baseball exciting aren't done anymore.
Action.
And there's – this all started – give me about 90 seconds to do
you
this.
You have all the time you want. That's what we all do right here.
Okay. This all started in the 90s between the Yankees and the Orioles when – teams started, you know, they started playing the 4-hour games. And what was happening is that they figured out, the really good hitting teams figured out that they wanted to get the starting pitchers out of games. So they're taking a lot of pitches. They're taking a lot of close pitches. And the point was to get a guy to throw 100-and-something pitches in five innings, get him out of the game, get to the bullpen, because at that time, the first two guys that they brought out of the bullpen were probably not very good. Because
they
that's
were failed
why
starters
yeah, exactly.
and failed closers.
And that was, you know, that was a great strategy. But then other little things began happening, and then that made games longer. The thing that makes games longer, and there are a lot of things that do it, but the one thing more than anything is you look at total pitches. Games today, guys are throwing, teams are throwing about 100 more pitches than they used to throw in like 1988. And you can see it right in the box scores. And if you add 20 seconds or even 25 seconds for every pitch, that all adds up. Now, there
were
a bunch
amazing.
Of other-
Pat, but when Jerry Remy died this week, and I thought about being a boy and seeing Jerry Remy in a Red Sox uniform in 1979 when I was down underneath the stadium, when Kiko Garcia hit a home run and I got to go to the hit and run bird feed room as a junior Oriole winner. I was 11. So I thought about Remy, and I thought, he didn't play with Louis. And I remember the first baseball game I ever went to, and I thought, Remy was an angel, and I could look him up. You know what I mean? Like, I was getting my old baseball card mind going from the early 70s. Yeah. And it reminded me of the first baseball game that I ever went to. Louis Aparicio was a Red Sox in 1973. And I didn't realize the Red Sox were good. They won 89. I thought they stunk. They didn't. 75 wasn't an aberration. They were working into that with Yaz. And
they started getting better in the early 70s. They had some nice teams, you know, with the – I remember them, you know, they won a pennant in 67, and a couple of those guys were still around.
Yeah, Tion, like Fisk, I mean, all of that, right? I mean, Cepeda was coming in, Ogilvy, they had Burleson, they had players, not just Lynn and Rice, but so 73 was the first time I went to a game, and I went to Baseball Reference, and it was September 8th and 9th. It was a two-game Red Sox series. I have a picture of me and Louie, you know, underneath the stadium from that, you know, literally I'm 4.5 years old. You can so I looked up the box scores just to see who was playing, you know, Rick Harper and, you know, whoever, right. Who was playing second base for the Red Sox at that point.
Tommy Harper, you probably mean.
Tommy Harper, Rick Miller, Tommy Harper.
There you go.
My bad. So anyway, I looked up the, there was a game that was 9-4, you know, Marty Patton started it. They, you know, there were 22 hits in the game, 2 hours and 38 minutes. 2 hours and 38 minutes, and there were 13 runs and 22 hits. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, you know, I'm just looked at it. There haven't been a 2-hour, 38-minute game in baseball in 20 years.
It's hard. And, you know, and part of it too is the breaks between every half inning used to be 1 minute. Now they're like 2 minutes and 30 something seconds.
I don't mind that when I go get a hot. I don't mind any of that. What I mind is when I sit down and watch the game, I'm checking my phone. I'm blowing my nose. I'm grabbing a sandwich. I'm surfing to something else. My mind's over here. Because staying with it, I don't know. It just sort of becomes a book that you're on page 15 and you're like, do I want to finish it? And do I have the belly to still be here at 10:48 tonight to see the ninth inning of this 14 pitchers later? Like, it's just – I don't know, man. I don't have anyone I know, and I like I've known Rosenthal my whole life. That if I really sat here with Ken on the second beer and said, "Dude, like, do you really like you're watching this? Is this really better? Is it more compelling? Is it more interesting? Is it more exciting? Is it better for storytelling?" I don't know, but and it's not Buck or Smoltz. It's not the broadcasters. I don't know. And it's not knowing the history of the game. I've dedicated my whole life to it. Oh, it's just this fly into like, do I care about Freddie Freeman or do I not?
Yeah, there, you know, we could probably take up an entire show and maybe an entire month of shows talking about how baseball has lost its way. And it's not a compelling game anymore for young people. There are a million things that baseball has done wrong in the pursuit of revenue that has put it in this precarious position. And on top of everything else, there may be a lockout December 1st.
Yeah, I haven't even brought that up. I covered that like oil. I mean, like seriously, I was on that because of the strike in 94. I learned that stuff when my dad canceled the sporting news in 81. And I spent 30 years on the radio here. And the first 10, it was labor with baseball. And to think that I have to relearn that this offseason to figure out what the hell they're fighting about now, like – they should really be fighting to fix their product. And I don't think they think anything's wrong. That's sort of the worst part of it, is the more I watch it, the more it's like nothing's wrong here. There's nothing to see.
And they'll continue to think that as long as people continue to pay exorbitant ticket prices and go to the games. But I'll tell you what, there are markets where you can't watch a game on television. There are markets where people are not going to games, or they're only going once a year. And there are markets where fans – here's what I see in Minnesota a lot, okay? You go to a Twins game.
It's a good baseball town, you would say, right?
It's a good baseball town, yeah. You go to a Twins game, and you see tons of people wearing jerseys of players who are no longer Twins. And the reason is because the jerseys are expensive. You can't drop $150 every 2 years on a new jersey for your new favorite player. But folks don't stay long enough for fans to
get attached
to them.
I would get a Carew jersey, 78, powder blue, done, over with.
Yeah, and there just you go. It. Yeah, and there are folks that do that. There are plenty of people who bought Joe Mauer jerseys when Joe was at the height of his career that will continue to wear them for probably another 20 years. I see all kinds of jerseys, but I don't see very many jerseys of the current players. And that's a problem. I can't tell you that that's the case in a lot of other cities, but I can tell you that folks, when you have fans that can't get attached to players because they're so – there's never been a time in baseball where players are more disposable to owners and general managers.
Well, they don't even really want starting pitchers because they don't want to pay them.
Yeah. Well, right? Nobody wants to pay – the only guys that are going to get their money, and this has been kind of a growing thing over the last 30 years, the only people who get paid now are superstars. Eddie Rosario was a Twin, came up through the farm system – played really hard, played hurt, did everything you want for a guy. They didn't want to go to arbitration with him and have to pay him $12 million, so they let him go. Nobody else signed him in the offseason. He ended up going to Cleveland on a minor league contract. So he's making like $8 million, and you see what he's doing in postseason. He's great. That's the thing. Guys like him, even 15 years ago, would have got a 3-year contract from their original team. Now, nobody wants to sign guys like this. He's a good player. And there are plenty of good players that don't get signed. If you were a first baseman 20 years ago and hit 20 home runs, you'd get a 3-year contract. You'd stay. Now, everybody's grandmother hits 20 home runs. So these guys
are. We got the Trey Mancini thing going on here, the wasted money on Chris Davis. And in our franchise, they'll talk about Rutschman and all that, but Manny Machado, they drafted and brought him in here and never even thought about keeping him. Like, just it didn't even occur to them. And he's a bit of a turd of a human being, as well. You don't want to invest for him. But when you lose 107 games, when your strategy is we're going to serve lousy coffee for 5 years in the hopes that maybe one day the cup will be drinkable, I don't know. Baseball's lost its way in that way for me here in Baltimore, just seeing how the community's been shat upon for 3 decades, and no one in New York even acknowledges that things are even a problem here to try to make it better. As a matter of fact, we get punished because the owner's such a creep. I mean, we had the All-Star game. We didn't have the All-Star game because we lost the All-Star game because our owner's a creep and he's suing them all. So, we're in the middle. We are the child in that divorce. And then the Nationals, it's even worse in markets where there was a history. And come on, man, you came in here, covered a lot of Yankees, Orioles games back in the day, ate crab cakes over at Fadley's. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know.
This was a serious thing here that they really, really effed up for the value of my home. They effed it up,
And that's really unfortunate.
Pat, I love having you on, dude. I'll have you on and yell about baseball and Olympics. So I'm probably going to upgrade next time and have your wife on and do some Olympics. But
always an upgrade, and that's a beautiful thing. She'd be terrific.
Hey, man, I appreciate the visit with you, and you give me a great old foe to argue with about baseball, and next time you're in crab cakes on me. And I look forward to get back out to the Twin Cities. I almost came out for the Stones a couple weeks ago when I blew my back out. Things got a little screwed up, but Minnesota's on my short list. My wife still hasn't been to a baseball game there, so at some point, summer night in Minnesota, probably a good place to be, except for the mosquitoes.
Absolutely. Right? Cannot be beat. Looking forward to seeing you. Thanks for having me on. Always fun. Always a good time.
Pat. Pat Borsey joining us here. He is at Minnesota. You can follow him out on Twitter and sports writings and the writings of his wife, and as well as the Vikings coming in here. Luke is in Owings Mills all week long. We'll have all the press conferences and all that stuff out at WNST. All of it brought to you by our friends at Royal Farms, real fresh, real fast. Doing the crab cake tour, getting back out, eating some turkey, finding some pumpkin and some eggnog at Wise Markets. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.